In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Lying is an explosive word. We hear it a lot in politics. Bush lied, people died. Clinton, take your pick which one, lied. But to say someone lied implies two things. One, you know that they're telling something not true. And two, you know that they know that they're not being truthful. Lying always implies an intent to deceive. So all of that to set the stage for what we're going to be talking about on today's show, something you're hearing an awful lot about lately in the news, and will continue to hear in the news, which is China lied about the virus. It's possible, and probably probable. What did China know, and when did they know it? Did they develop and then release the virus, or was it a massive screw-up on a pandemic scale? Did elements in China act on their own? Perhaps the Chinese government itself didn't know anything, but maybe elements within their military knowingly sent infected people out into the West. It's possible. But don't think this is too far-fetched. After all, we know Iran trains and then sends suicide bombers into Israel and the West. Iran has close ties to China. Is it that hard to imagine that China would send infected suicide bombers of its own once infected with a coronavirus? After all, we already know that they think nothing of killing millions of their own citizens. So is it possible? Absolutely. Did they? We just don't know. Not yet, anyway. But federal investigators are looking at some curious travel patterns coming out of China early on in all of this, which is why I say you'll be hearing a lot more about whether or not China lied. Here in the United States, we may also soon be asking who knew what and when did they know it? Did people lie about the disease, about the spread of it, about the severity of it, and so much more? And what about those models? The ones that shut down the entire world's economy with almost no genuine data to begin with. The models have been proven wrong, and there was no way that they could have been right given the fact that they had almost no real data to go on and from which to build those models. In a lot of ways, we're really coming full circle here on iSpy Radio. When we first started back in 2011, one of our very first shows focused on why our government officials are never held accountable for their own actions. And it turns out that there are laws and regulations preventing them from being held accountable, personally accountable, for their actions and decision-making. So what if you spend $1 billion on a healthcare website that never gets going? It doesn't matter. You're a government employee. You can't be held responsible. A lot of times, they're not even fired, and if they are, they still get their full retirement. Just try losing $1 billion in the private sector and see if no one notices. On today's show, we'll be talking about those models and about China. I'd like to welcome Dr. Tim Ball back to the show. He's a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg. He's an historical climatologist, best known for his public opposition to the so-called scientific consensus in the global warming controversy. And Dr. Tim, it's always great to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's especially good in this time of shutdown.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's just really been crazy to experience everything that we're experiencing. In my wildest dreams a year ago, I would have never thought we'd be where we are today, for sure. You have, in addition to being a climatologist, you have some other qualifications that we want to tap into. But we'll talk about a little bit about that in the next segment. But just to get us going, you know, we don't hear an awful lot about Canada in our news feeds unless they've done something really horrifically wrong. But I mean, how are you guys doing up there? And do Canadians feel good about their much vaunted healthcare system that is the envy of people like Michael Moore?
I think that if you ask a Canadian how it's different from America, they'll inevitably track around to the healthcare system, Medicare. So there is a sort of a national pride about it. And it's not a particularly good system, as we've discussed, and it never can be when it's a government-run thing. Hmm. But the fact that a Canadian doesn't even think twice about health care or the cost of health care, I mean, if you get sick, you just go to a doctor or a hospital of your choice, and that's the end of it. Hmm. So there is that benefit of access to a system. But then there's the question of whether the system is very good or not.
Right.
And so just having a system in and of itself doesn't necessarily guarantee any reasonable service.
Hmm. Well, I think that's the thing that's always left out of those debates about free health care. Certainly Bernie was always pushing, you know, we need to have access to health care. Well, so what? I mean, if you can't get the test done that you want, if you can't get the care that you want, so what good does having access to health care mean? And of course, they always leave that out of the argument, too, is that they just assume that you, under their system, you can get access to the most expensive test possible. And that's just simply not the case. But setting that aside, I'd like to talk to you a little bit, just to get us warmed up here, about the coronavirus, because...
Can I just stop you for a second? Sorry, everybody, but that last point that you made of access to service, you have no control over it. If you pay, you get what you pay for. If you don't upfront pay, then you get what you're given. And you have no idea whether you're getting the right service, the bad service, the good service. You simply have no idea. And so you don't get to choose the doctor you want. You get, as I said, you're not paying, so you get what you're given, and that's the end of it. Wow. And that is not a good system at all.
No, that always gets left out of the debate there. Kind of one of those marketing points that they managed to just conveniently forget about.
Exactly.
One of the reasons why I had wanted to talk to you about the coronavirus and China and all the rest is because when the coronavirus first started and they were using this single model essentially to shut down pretty much the entire world, and I couldn't help but think this is the same kind of professional fear-mongering that we have seen for decades now in the global warming debate. Use a model that shows dire consequences if we don't do something, and then use complex mathematical models that most people simply don't understand and therefore can't dispute, and then use all of that to use the guise of professionals and whatnot, and use all of that to scare people into taking an action. Did you see these as similar tactics to the global warming debate, or do you see this as something very different?
No, it's exactly the same. The key word in all of this is model. Everything is now being done and run by computer models. And people, this adoration of numbers, mathematics, somehow because it's got a number, it's got absolute credibility and reliability, which is anything but true. And then the use of the computer involved with that is, oh, well, it's got to be accurate. It came from a computer. The computer is a model, and a model is an average, and the model only gives you what you've put into it, what you've built into it. It can only provide answers within the range of what it's been programmed for. But the whole leadership of the world has become so controlled by models and model predictions that common sense, for example, how do you model common sense? You just simply can't do it. And so it's got to devolve to probabilities and estimates of numbers, and of course those are all human determinations, and seriously limit the results that you can get out of it. So we've become a world controlled by models, both in terms of policies and planning and everything else, but also in terms of how we respond to issues and problems. And to me, it's leading us into an absolute dead end.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Common sense has certainly gone out the window there. And that's really, when you have a model like that, you need the common sense in order to be able to interpret it. And unfortunately, I just don't see that we're seeing that really in any of this. Let's go and take a break there. Come back. We'll have more with Dr. Tim Ball coming up. We'll be talking about China. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Tim Ball. He's a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg. When we have him on, we're normally talking about global warming, although this time around we're going to be tapping into some other fields of expertise of his. And before we get into that, though, there was one question I had wanted to ask you in that last segment, is that how did we get to the point that government relies so much on a single set of experts or a single model. I mean, wasn't that part of the whole great global warming debates that you're supposed to have thousands of all of these scientists all agreeing? But in the case of the coronavirus, we have a relatively few number of experts and basically one or two models, and just everyone else has fallen into line. Why the difference, do you think?
Well, of course, the ideal was that you had a lot of experts and you listened to them all, and you made your decision based on a wide range. We still have that to some extent, but what's happened is now that if you get information and experts basing their information on model output, that has become sacrosanct. Mm-hmm. People think that because a model did it and because a computer did it, it is unassailable. And so we're now being run by politicians who say to the experts, well, what is the range of ideas here? And they come back with a range that has been generated by a computer model. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we're literally being run by computer models. That can't fit the world. You simply can't model the world. You can't, for example, there are so many points of data that are so critical in our thinking and thought making and decision making processes that simply don't fit a computer model. Mm-hmm. One of them, of course, is common sense. And there are so many other factors that go into making up your decision making that have now been virtually eliminated by the computer, and so we're seeing the results of that. The models fail, the predictions fail, the policies fail, and we're seeing that everywhere we look.
I think that it's crazy that we have given over our control to these models. We'll come back to the tyranny of experts maybe in a later segment. But in terms of China, usually when we have you on, it's to talk about global warming. But you have also taught classes in geopolitics and stuff. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about your qualifications to talk about China?
Well, yes, I taught the obvious outcome of studying climate was studying the impact of climate on human history. Mm-hmm. And of course, that leads to how people react to climate change and have reacted to climate change, and the extent to which it dictates virtually everything we do, because it dictates, if nothing else, the food supply and the variability in food supply from year to year. But the other side of that is the geopolitical side of it, because you cannot, you can look at the history of an idea and you look at the politics of an idea, but until you put them together in a geopolitical context, they really don't make any sense. The value of, for example, of a strait or some particular region of the sea that is of great influence, until you have that in and understand the influence of that, you're never going to understand what's going on in the world.
Now, you told us off air that you had some military experience and you had a top secret clearance as well. So, and this was part of your field of study, correct?
Yes. Well, when I was in the military and we were doing anti-submarine work, of course, that required a complete understanding of the geopolitics of the world. And what you learn very quickly is how the oceans and control of the oceans and the control of the waterways really dictates human history. If you look at, say, the influence of the Panama Canal opening up and how that changed the whole pattern of North and South America and the Western world, and then you look at the influence of the Suez Canal when Egypt took control of that, how that immediately almost shut down the world. And so you find out very quickly that the oceans and the canals and so on are very central to understanding history. Mm. And that's what's happening right now. That's why certain countries, for example, the location of a country and its relationship to other countries makes it very, very powerful, but people don't understand why. I mean, if you look at Turkey, for example, I mean, the Americans fell over backwards to keep Turkey in NATO and gave them virtually everything, because Turkey is the only country that shares a common border with Russia and the Western world. So it was the only direct link between what was then the Soviet Union and the Western world.
And of course, it's strategically placed, too, to the Middle East as well, for sure.
Oh, exactly. Right, so, in the center of it, yeah.
Well, in terms of China, the West really seems to keep thinking that China wants the same things as the West does, peace and prosperity for all. And I know that you and I have talked in the past about this, this really is a colossal mistake on the part of the West, that China actually wants instead world domination with China at the top. Why do you think people in the West just don't get it, that China actually means it when they say they want to dominate the world?
I've struggled with that for years now. And yeah, China states it very bluntly. Their goal is to control the world. And I suspect that the reason is because through history, others have tried to control the world and failed. I mean, that was Hitler's goal, that was Stalin's goal, and none of them have been able to do it. The question is whether China is able to succeed where others have failed. There are several factors that count into this. One is their sheer size, the size of China. People think about China only in terms of the coastal region, but you go back beyond the Snowy Mountains and into Western China. It's a huge country, yes. Second largest country in the world, and the resources that it controls. The other thing is that China's history has been what we call an inward-looking nation. Most other nations got into colonialism and occupying other parts of the world. China had never done that before, but now China's doing it in a different way. They're not doing it in pure occupants of the land. In other words, colonialism. They're doing it intellectually and culturally.
Well, and from an economic standpoint too. They will sell you things, but boy, there is an awful lot of strings attached. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, more on China and the lies they tell. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. Tim Ball. He's a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg. Usually when we talk to him, it's about global warming and climate change and some of that nonsense. But today we're talking about something a little, I guess, more tangible in some ways. We're talking about China, tapping into his background in the Cold War and studying China and both Russia as opponents to the United States and Canada. And in terms of China there, knowing that China wants to dominate the world, why do you think the U.S. And so much of the Western countries ignored that and instead went ahead and opened these factories in China, putting so much of our supply chain in their hands? In the case of these corporations, was it simply to increase their own profits? Were they willingly blind? Did they just not believe it? Or were they deceived and honestly didn't know?
Yeah, the interesting thing about capitalism is it's like all single-minded things. It has a blindness. It has a tunnel vision. And so it will go, if they think there's a way of making money, capitalists will be there. That doesn't guarantee it at all. And in fact, it almost guarantees your failure, because those things that will defeat capitalism will do that. And of course, what China's doing is, and it stated its goal of wanting to control the world, but it wants to control it ideologically, not necessarily in occupation. China's never been a colonial power like Britain and Europe was in the 18th and 19th centuries. So people really didn't listen to China in the sense of when they said, well, we want to control the world. People assumed it was in the physical sense, but it wasn't. And of course, what they're trying to do is to switch the world to the communist ideology of a central government that tells you everything to do in your life and your day.
Historically speaking, yeah. Has China always wanted to dominate the world, or was it only since the communists took over?
It's only since the communists took over. There's always been emperors who want to control and dominate China, but their ambition beyond China was very, very limited. Hmm. They would, if a country close on the border with China caused any trouble, they'd go in and squash it. But they very, very rarely stayed there to occupy it. You can look at Tibet as an example. And so China has never been involved in colonialism in the Western sense. But in the sense of ideology, that's a different picture altogether. That China wants to dictate and control the people of the world through ideology, but not by occupying their country.
Hmm. Well, in terms of when these corporations all started moving into China, it almost seems like they didn't want to admit the fact that these Chinese communists wanted to take over the world. And what I have never understood is that when you moved in there, you had to give China, the state of China, 51% control in your company. And you had to give them access to all of your trade secrets. I've never understood why these corporations would be so willing to do that. Because why would you want to hand anybody your trade secrets? Eventually, they're going to start copying it. Eventually, they're going to make it themselves. And we've seen that. So was there an element of maybe racism in there that these corporations just didn't think that China could or would do that?
Yeah, as I said earlier, it's a very complex thing. But basically, the Chinese don't want to occupy land. What they want to do is occupy your mind, and therefore, they didn't have land ambitions like the traditional European colonials did, and it's a colonialism that the West simply doesn't understand. And one of the things, of course, is that they want an emperor. They want a central control. Well, China's always had that. The emperors have always had absolute control over everything. Mm. So the fact that they're now essentially elected is really no different than what it's been historically.
Well, they were certainly trying to take over economically, dominate the world. Do you see that as a result of all of this, that we're going to start moving our supply chains out, that we're going to start abandoning some of these factories in China? And so then what happens for China? Are they going to continue to make those chips and stuff and sell them on their own? Are they going to then be our direct competitors and not simply be part of that supply chain? What do you see happening?
Well, I think that this latest world impact, and I go back to the idea I was starting to formulate at the beginning. Orson Welles with his play back in the 30s, it was all about an invasion of Martians, and people listening to the play started to believe it. And there was all sorts of hundreds of riots in the streets across America and the Western world about this Martian invasion, that the Martians had come and were taken over. And of course, the one thing that unifies people is a threat from the outside. And so what you see going on here is that the Chinese are going to control you by threatening you with an invasion from the outside. That's what's happening here. That you're so busy wondering and worrying about what they're doing that they're literally controlling you. Hmm. And so this is why it's an ideological control and not a physical control.
Yeah.
And when you say to people, you know, what's your worry about China? Well, people can't even imagine 1.2 billion people.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, I certainly think that Apple just on Thursday announced that they're going to start making their own chips. So I think that's a good indication of where the future of a lot of American manufacturing is going is I think we're going to start pulling some of that back overseas, and that's going to create its own interesting dynamic as far as economics is concerned. All right, coming up, did China lie about the virus? Stay with us. More with Dr. Tim Ball. And welcome back. Talking today about China. We're doing that with Dr. Tim Ball. He's not only a world-famous skeptic on global warming, but he's also an expert on geopolitics, and especially on China. And so in terms of China here, this has really kind of been an ongoing and developing meme, really, over the last few weeks, is that China has lied about the origins of this. They have been trying to push some disinformation out into the U.S. saying that the U.S. military had started this and then imported it into Wuhan. But it's been interesting to watch this unfold. But in terms of China itself, I'd like to understand the culture a little bit more and tap into your knowledge on that. In the U.S. and most of the West, where Judeo-Christian values dominate, lying and deception is generally considered a bad thing. It's unethical. In the Middle East, lying is acceptable as long as it furthers the goals of Islam. So how is lying and deception viewed within China?
Well, the Chinese believe that you control the individual by controlling the ideas that they have. And so the schooling system, of course, is absolutely essential. And you see that the first thing that the Chinese communists did was to establish total control of the school system right through to the universities. And so it's in that intellectual control that you control the ideas and the way that you want the country to go. But China is very, very different in terms of also its history. It has a history of absolute central control. And when you look at the powers of the Chinese emperors, total and absolute control. They could literally kill millions of people to achieve what they wanted to do. So the Chinese are used to that idea of very powerful emperors that control everything. So they're very malleable to a powerful central government, which of course the communists have achieved. So that's the background of it. But having said all of that, China, yes, it occupies a very large area on the map of the world, but China within itself is a very, very divided country. Hmm. For example, Mao Zedong said that when they said, what's the most important thing that you achieved? And everybody thought, you know, that he would say, oh, communism and so on. He said, the bridge at Wuhan. And everybody stepped back and said, what the hell are you talking about? And what he was talking about is the city of Wuhan, which is about 1,000 miles inland on the Yangtze River. And until Mao came in, there was no way of getting across that Yangtze River, and he built the bridge at Wuhan that was the first physical connection between northern China and southern China. Hmm. And they are very, very different regions. They're different culturally. You've got the Cantonese in the south and the Han people in the north. They're physically very different. The languages are different. The Han people are very big, large head, tall people, whereas the Chinese that the West know are the small, short Cantonese people of the south. And then within the middle of all that, you've got the Manchurian Basin, which is a complete river basin where the rivers flow inward, and it is essentially isolated from the rest of China. And in fact, during the communist control of China, it stayed outside of any attempts by the communists to take control of it. So China is anything but a single nation, and those divisions and battles are going on all the time.
Well, and so given all of those different divisions, it sounds like it would be perfectly acceptable. In order to maintain control, lying would be part of that. And so I guess maybe the question is, does China understand the West and how the West views lying?
I don't think China cares. Huh. That's the whole point. See, one of the things that's happened with colonialism is that countries and places around the world so much wanted to be part of colonialism that they were prepared to indoctrinate their people into the colonial way of thinking. The Chinese were never willing to do that, and in fact still resist it. And China, it calls itself the Middle Kingdom for a reason, because it sees itself as the center of the world. And therefore, they're only intellectually and marginally interested in what's going on in the rest of the world, and only intellectually interested in the sense that can I make money out of it, and does it have any application in China? That's completely different from the rest of the world, where colonialism came along and people wanted to be part of colonialism and change their languages and their culture and everything. China's doing exactly the opposite.
Well, in terms of the virus, do you think that China intentionally lied about the virus, or was it more they were trying to save face and so were sort of, in their view, maybe white lies, or maybe perhaps they were totally mortified that this happened and just simply didn't want people to find out? Or did they purposefully lie to let this slip out of China? And so what if it infected the rest of the world? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's an almost impossible question to answer, both in the context of how the Chinese think and how the rest of the world think. What China's view of it would be historically is, look, here's something that's very dramatic and has galvanized the world, and how can we use that to our advantage? See, instead of like the West, fighting and resisting everything, putting together an army to go and fight it, the Chinese look at it and say, how can we adapt it, bend it? It's the whole idea of jujitsu. In terms of the West, your fighting was all about bigger guns, bigger arms, bigger punching. Jiu-jitsu is exactly the opposite. You take the strength of the enemy and turn it to your advantage. And so this is how they think intellectually as well.
It sounds a lot like we hear from the socialists here in America, never let a crisis go to waste. So, all right, let's go and take a break there. Come back, we'll have more Dr. Dimbal talking about China and the virus. Stay with us. And welcome back. Talking today to Dr. Tim Ball. Normally we talk to him about climate change and that scam, but today we're talking much more about China and what's going on there. And in that last segment, we were talking about China potentially lying about the virus. And in terms of one of the things that people talk about is that maybe this was released on purpose. And in that last segment, you were clearly indicating that there was a real willingness to kill people, certainly their own people. We've definitely seen that over the history of China. Is it possible that this virus was released on purpose? Because, you know, it kind of came on the heels of them folding in the trade negotiations, and so maybe there's a sense of embarrassment there. Is it possible that this was intentional? What are your thoughts?
It's certainly possible. China's the one thing that is China's absolute weakness is its own self-image. And it will do anything to maintain that and to keep it in good light. And so if they saw this as being something that would put them into a very, very negative view from the world, they certainly would do what they did. And so image to the Chinese, which ironically the West doesn't think they care about their image, but in fact it's everything to them. As I said in the earlier segment, that's why it calls itself the Middle Kingdom. It sees itself as the intellectual center of the world, and will do anything to maintain that. And the worst thing somebody from China can do is do or say anything that denigrates China.
Is that punishable by death in some cases?
The way they do death nowadays is far more subtle and is hard to distinguish as a deliberate death. But certainly in history it was, yes.
In this segment, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the tyranny of experts, because I think as we are starting to now kind of turn the corner, it's looking more and more like we have turned the corner here on the virus. And yet we are, as we had said in that first segment, we really seem to be driving government now via models. And there was a really interesting article on the American Institute for Economic Research called The Tyranny of, and then in parentheses, Alleged Experts. And Professor, and I just like to read a little bit of this, says, Professor Israel found that no matter how much or how little politicians corn the population, coronavirus peaked and subsided in exactly the same way. Whether the country relied on politicians shutting down the country, such as the U.S. and U.K., for example, or private voluntary actions, such in Sweden, Professor Israel's work showed that, quote, all countries experienced seemingly identical coronavirus infection patterns, with the number of infected peaking in the sixth week and rapidly subsiding by the eighth week. In short, coercive measures imposed to protect the public from COVID-19 are as effective as throwing magical tiger dust in Central Park to keep tigers at bay in Manhattan. So in terms of these experts, because we have now shut down so much of the world's economy based on these models, talk to us a little bit about the tyranny of experts, because we see this in every field, don't we?
Well, yes, and it's actually what's destroying the modern world. And it's the difference. For example, the opposite of an expert or a specialist is a generalist. And you're not allowed to be a generalist. If you're a generalist, it's assumed you don't know anything. You have a whole lot of useless information. Whereas a specialist, oh yeah, he knows one thing with such extreme precision. And then the mistake we make is that, oh, well, that means that he knows everything in the whole world with extreme precision. He doesn't. It's like the useful idiot. You know, that the person knows one thing about one small area, and because of that, they're given all sorts of expertise and qualifications that they're simply not entitled to.
You know, and that's so different from where things used to be, even, you know, just 100 years or so ago, where it was really, it was the notion of the Renaissance man, where you had experience and knowledge in a wide variety of fields, and that was considered the epitome of education, was that you knew a lot about a lot of things, and now it's, you know, entirely about one thing.
Yes, and that's been the huge change in the world. And it came about with the proliferation of knowledge and information. And you can really put that in the year 1859. Now, Darwin, of course, created a generalist biological view of the world. And it was wonderful. But it was probably the last time that that sort of thing can occur in today's world, because of what Darwin did, people went out and started logging and mapping and recording and naming all the plants and animals and species on the planet. And we still haven't done it all. In fact, the estimates are that we've only found and named 35% of all the plants and animals on the planet. But the people think, oh no, we know everything about the planet because we know about all the plants and animals.
And
we don't.
Exactly. And the more that you know about things, the more that you ought to be realizing how little you actually know about the entire scope of knowledge to be had. I thought this was very interesting from Dinesh D'Souza. He said, Dr. Fauci is a quintessential scientist, invaluable for his expertise in his one area, but he's a constitutional dunce, a political dunce, and an economic dunce. We should no more take his counsel on those matters than we should ask a top-flight lawyer or economist to develop a vaccine. And I think he's exactly right.
Oh, he's totally right. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, I call it the chat show syndrome, that you get some person that won the world the pumpkin seed spitting contest, and then they're on a chat show in the evening, and they're saying, well, what do you think of the world? What's your values and so on? I don't care. Go spit your pumpkin seeds, you know. But this is the glorification of a specialist into a generalist, and it's just insane.
Well, in terms of combating some of these the tyranny of experts, I mean, how do you argue a negative? For example, we hear people say that if we hadn't shut down the economy, there'd be deaths in the millions. And first of all, I don't believe that to be true because of the impact of herd immunity. There's a lot of very qualified people from Oxford and other places that say that we've actually probably taken the wrong steps here. But I think that in itself means we may have done the wrong thing by closing things down. But now that we did take those actions, we can never really prove the opposite would have been more effective, can we?
That's right. Once you've made a move, then you can't reconstitute the world as it was and then how it changed.
This is always going to be the response, is we always need to shut down the economy because it worked last time. I mean, isn't that the danger here?
Yes, it's simplistic ideological approach to things, and if you look at history, that has happened throughout history, and so some new culture or regime or political approach to the world comes in, and then it starts examining itself and looking at itself until it literally vanishes up its own backside. And this is the problem.
Yeah.
If you start to analyze things, you won't find the answers that you want, but you will end up destroying what you're analyzing.
Well, this is a frightening prospect. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll wrap things up with Dr. Tim. Stay with us. Final segment now, talking with Dr. Tim Ball. And Dr. Tim, I got to tell you, that's a rather frightening prospect, is that now that we've shut down the economy and locking people away, that's going to be the new model going forward. Because that has been one thing I have asked several people, and nobody seems to have a genuine response to, is, okay, so what do we do next year? What do we do for the next virus? I mean, is that really, you think, going to be the new model going forward? Is that we're going to just have to shut down every time a virus comes along?
Well, the problem is if something works, people keep doing it, even if it only appears to work, and that's the difficulty. And this is the of course the other side of that is that people want to control society, and so when they see something like this that allows them to take control by saying, "Look, if you don't listen to me, the sky's going to fall." So this is the classic Chicken Little sky is falling syndrome. If you don't listen to me and allow me to control this pandemic by controlling people and locking them up, then the whole world's going to collapse. So it's not just the event, but the exploitation of it that's the threat.
Well, when you look at places like Sweden, because there was a great article that we'll make sure we put up on this week's show page, is that they were showing that by shutting down the economy like what they did in the UK didn't seem to impact things any better than what Sweden did, which is they did not shut down their economy. They used basically hand washing and social distancing, and they were as effective, if not better in some ways, than what the UK did. So going forward, is it possible that we'll look to Sweden and say, well, you know, they didn't destroy their economy, and they came through it just fine? Do you think maybe cooler heads will prevail in the future as we look back at this?
No, unfortunately, it won't, because people that want to inflict their ideas and control on society will always be with us. And unless you limit them and block them, they will always step forward with their ideas. And if you notice that the governments that did nothing ended up dealing with it better than anybody.
Yes.
And one of the things that, of course, is the arrogance of these people with ideas and think that they're leaders is that they don't believe that the public know what's going on or capable of coping. All the studies done, I mean, you can go back and read them in the psychology literature where, you know, they go to an island and introduce an axe and then study what impact the axe has on the whole structure of the society. And societies have incredible techniques and abilities to accommodate and adjust and to work things into their environment and their situation. But we don't believe that. So we elect leaders or people that tell us, oh, well, we can make things better. It's absolute lies. They can't. If you leave people to their own devices, they will work things out for the best. But we simply don't let that happen. Simply doesn't happen.
No. Well, on the other side of this, do you think that there's a chance that we will trust models a little less, or are we condemned to believing them even more than before?
No, the models are just like everything else. They're another fad. The computer came in with using numbers and electronics and as I said had an attraction to people because it was quotes unquote new and unique, and therefore there was this naive belief that it would solve the problems. They never have and they never will. And what will happen is, of course, that models will, as they're already doing, take their role in society as superb recorders and maintainers of vast amounts of data and the ability to manipulate and play with that data. But what data you use and how you manipulate it and play with it predetermines the answers you get. So the model itself hasn't changed anything. All it's done is allow us to collect more data and manipulate more data. But that doesn't improve.
And manipulate people more, too, for sure. We got about a minute and change here with you. Aside from trusting models more or less, clearly the models, the early models, were very wrong, although now they're saying, well, they would have been right if we hadn't done anything. And again, we're back to you can't prove that. But do you think that now that we have seen that we have shut down the entire economy, something like 26 million people are out of work now here in the U.S., do you think that we'll be trusting government agencies more or less in the future?
Well, it'll be less because every time that the government step in and try to solve a problem, they fail. And they simply can't succeed. But one of the problems that they can't succeed is the same as with the models. You see, in the model, how do you quantify common sense? How do you quantify human feelings? How do you quantify human behavior? And so it's that balance that's going on in our society between quality and quantity. And so that you've got quantities, but that doesn't guarantee quality at all.
We certainly know that there's going to be another virus, but let's hope that next time common sense prevails. So, Dr. Tim, enjoyed this conversation very much. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
You know, I started the show by talking about the lack of liability in government for making colossal mistakes. We will probably not see that for this shutdown, unfortunately. But I certainly hope that on the other side of this, that going forward, there must be some sort of personal responsibility and liability for those who put together models if they get things wrong. Because if we're entering the dangerous territory of governance by computer models, those who create them need to be liable for them. After all, holding government accountable is the hallmark of American independence. Having no responsibility for bad decisions is the hallmark of dictators. And it's time we hold people accountable, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.